Charlie, given that we have a relentless drumbeat of bad news from the climate scientists and that emissions go on going up faster and faster, do you feel as optimistic as these two others do?
I think I look at it slightly differently. I don't think you could be an environmentalist for 20 years and not have some innate sense of optimism, or you wouldn't keep coming to work. But I really do disagree with Dave in that although I think there's been a lot of noise around climate change last year, and clearly the climate science has advanced, you know, beyond all recognition. Actually, emissions have continued to rise quite dramatically in the United States, you know, on very, very dramatically in China, which isn't surprising, or countries like India. But worryingly, even a progressive market leader like the UK, which was, you know, for many years considered, at least in rhetorical terms, to be at the forefront of international climate diplomacy, most of the gains were made for a series of one-off or structural adjustments to a couple of industrial strategies or power sectors in the 1990s. And since then, every indication has actually gone the wrong way. And I would question how serious companies are at the broadest level about climate change if you've got companies like RWE or E.ON, big European utilities, which are not just, you know, inclined to, but are absolutely intent on building new unabated coal-fired power stations using technologies that are incrementally better than the boilers of the 1930s, but only just, leading to what will be absolutely enormous increases in carbon emissions from the power sector, combined with, of course, you know, recent decisions around infrastructure like Runway 3 at Heathrow. So I'm not optimistic at all about what the government or industry has put on the table so far. I am optimistic about what's possible to achieve. But I think even just today, amongst the four of us discussing it, there's been the idea that unending economic growth, at least on the scale and in the pattern that we've been experiencing in the last 30, 40 years, the post-war boom, has to be an inevitable outcome. And I think there are going to be, and Greenpeace thinks there are going to have to be some kind of trade-offs, not just in terms of consumption, but in distribution of consumption. And if poverty eradication, which Greenpeace takes very seriously in the developing world, is going to happen simultaneously with responding to climate change, there actually are going to have to be some negotiations about who gets what and how much and when. And that has not been a very obvious part of the climate negotiations so far. It's been classic power politics. And in that regard, it's been exactly like the trade negotiations in the WTO.
Do you mean you're going to have to make rich people poorer if you're going to make poor people richer?
I think that at the very least, rich people are going to have to contemplate getting richer at a much, much slower rate. And I think that if you look at some of the work that people like the New Economics Foundation have done, is you have to find a much better measurement of prosperity than crude GDP. And at the moment, that's not currently even part of the conversation.
What I would like from you now, if you wouldn't mind, is a fairly clear, brief sense of what in policy terms we need from the Obama administration and then globally in order to tackle this problem seriously.
The first thing we need is lots of public spending, and we need lots of public spending on the transformational technology change that we need. You're not going to get that from a carbon price. Now, you're not going to get that without a carbon price, but carbon prices will produce change at the margin. Because of the nature of this problem, we need transformational change. We need change in a specific time. So you're going to have to spend and be prepared to spend a lot of public money. Now, we're going to spend a lot of public money anyway on the recovery packages. So the issue is, what do you spend it on? Not just how much do you spend, but what do you spend it on? And if we're spending that on energy efficiency, on deploying the renewables and deploying carbon capture and storage, then, as I said earlier, we're getting onto at least the beginning of a pathway to a low carbon economy. If we miss this chance, then I think life is going to get very hard indeed. But even that won't be enough, and we really are going to have to do a lot more regulation. We've, I think, had pretty kind of brutal lesson in the downside of living in a very deregulated world. I think that's just as true for climate change as it is for the economy as a whole. And so there are areas where we really need to do things through regulation much more effectively. You look at the California Climate Action Plan, for instance, which is one of the most advanced and most praised plans. You look at what actually they're doing an awful lot of work using things like building standards, appliance standards to drive things forward. Now, I'm very much in the Michael Porter camp of thinking that actually the right kind of regulation deployed in the right way and at the right time drives technological advance and brings with it economic productivity gains. So one of the things you've really got to avoid doing is making false choices.
And the carbon price that you're talking about, how would you get that carbon price and how would it work?
If I could trust governments, then I would get it by a carbon tax because it creates a sort of predictability. But I'm not relying on the price signal to bring about the change. I would then do what we've seen has worked, for instance, with the Swedish NOx tax. I would then hypothecate, though dreadful word that, hypothecate those revenues towards making the technology shifts we need to make. Now, the advantage of that is politically, it's transparent. You have a self-sunsetting tax. As you drive down your carbon emissions, so you need less and less tax to get the next step. And so the public can see that they're not being, as it were, hijacked by stealth taxes. I think that's pretty important. I think trading in some places will have a part to play, and maybe particularly with the power sector, if we can stop the power sector sort of double dipping on the revenues on it. But I think trading may have some role to play, but it has very high transactional costs. And the idea that we're going to build a global carbon market anytime soon, even with everybody pulling the same way, which they're not, doesn't really take much account of the kind of thing it's taken to build any kind of global market. It takes a long time. Time is the one resource we don't have with this problem.
Dave, would you go with that? Very heavy public spending, heavier regulation than we have at the moment, and a carbon tax?
Mostly. I certainly go with smart regulation, which is what I took Tom to be meaning, rather than heavy. And I think there's a hell of a lot of the gains that we're after that are not inspiring and not terribly glamorous, like building insulation, things like that, which could well be a part of those sorts of initiatives. Tax versus trading, I'm a bit of an agnostic on that one, because as I understand the economics, it's that it turns on the marginal benefit of abatement of the thing you're trying to get rid of, and that you prefer in the case of carbon, you would prefer taxes in the short term and trading in the long, and that poses all sorts of challenges. But the four things I think will be needed are big initiatives on carbon accounting, because it becomes very obvious if you try and produce a trading system that you need good solid carbon accounting, and in fact the initial allocations of the EU emissions trading system showed what happens when you don't. But even if you have a tax, you're going to want to know what you ought to be paying tax on. And I don't think at the moment there's any internationally agreed framework that everybody finds compelling. So I think one thing we'll need to get to grips with is finding ways of accounting embedded carbon across a vast range of processes. And thinking about timescales associated with the climate, we often hear claims that climate is urgent in one sense or another, and there are times when that's probably right, and there are times when it's exaggerated. And I think it often depends on the sort of churn timescale of the industry you're talking about, and things like coal-fired power plants, which are going to be around for 60-odd years. Obviously, if you build one of those today, anywhere in the world, you need to think of the emissions implications under whatever global scheme you're intending to bring in. You need to think about the emission implications in 60 years' time. So quite often, although people have space under some sort of emissions plan that they may be advocating today, they run out of room quite rapidly with that. So, but then there are other sectors, like, as I mentioned, building insulation, where you could do things quite fast. So I think timescale, unpacking that and bringing that into the policy arena would be really useful. And doing things efficiently so as to not be more welfare reducing than they need to be is obviously pretty key, because there's so many other things we want to do. And finally, to make equitable policy. It's an easy thing to say, and it's a really hard thing to do, because it brings to the fore all sorts of issues about the framing of the problem. How broad is climate policy? What other policies does it need to be bundled in with? And what other policies does it leave outside its realm? And I think that's really easy to answer that naively, or to answer it badly. And I think that I'd like to see a lot more of the negotiations being around development, trade, and a variety of other things as well, such as corruption. Because we have this intergovernmental process, and where many of the governments aren't necessarily great with public funds, it runs the risk of eroding political will in the developed world, as well as being detrimental to the welfare of the people on whose behalf these transfers are being initiated.
Charlie, any other bases that you want to cover on the policy front?
No, I think Dave and Tom have covered pretty much everything that I would have picked up on. I think there's something though that Dave mentioned that I think is really interesting, talking about the political process and the negotiations that are ongoing. the Copenhagen deadline of 2009 for negotiating a successor to the Kyoto Protocol means that the ideas will have an ongoing regime, you know, which will begin in 2012 and carry on onwards. But the decisions that are being taken now about new power stations, about new runways, infrastructure that's going to have a very, very long lifetime and run the risks of being, you know, severely stranded assets in economic terms and real white elephants in environmental terms, those decisions are being taken almost irrespective of that political multilateral political process, which for all its flaws is very attractive because it's a multilateral process. And there is this real tension, I think, between, you know, the sense of urgency which people like, you know, Greenpeace and others constantly go on about, and the sense of the ongoing march of progress that, you know, quite reasonably people responsible for the economy have to take responsibility for. And that tension, I don't see it being resolved in any way or even being publicly explored in current decision making. And so it just stays there, and the whole circus goes on and on and on year on year. You know, you get thousands of people rocking up to these things. You make this tiny progress in the sort of incremental negotiations. But the decisions that are going to affect those outcomes beyond 2015, 2020 are rolling onwards with very little input. We really need to find some way, whether it's in policy terms or political terms or even activism terms, to address that tension, because without it, we'll have an agreement. It might even be a good agreement, but it won't actually do the thing that we need it to do, which is to avert the worst impacts on the climate.